paired with science in precisely the way courts always worried tissue donors might do. "It's ironic," she told me. The Moore court's concern was, if you give a person property rights in their tissues, it would slow down research because people might withhold access for money. But the Moore decision backfired. It just handed that commercial value to researchers. According to Andrews and a dissenting California Supreme Court judge, the ruling didn't prevent commercialization. It just took patients out of the equation and emboldened scientists to commodify tissues in increasing numbers. Andrews and many others have argued that this makes scientists less likely to share samples and results, which slows research. They also worry that it interferes with healthcare delivery. There is some evidence to support their claim. One survey found that 53% of laboratories had stopped offering or developing at least one genetic test because of patent enforcement, and 67% felt patents interfered with medical research. Because of patent licensing fees, it costs $25,000 for an academic institution to license the gene for researching a common blood disorder, hereditary hemochromatosis, and up to $250,000 to license the same gene for commercial testing. At that rate, it would cost anywhere from $46.4 million for academic institutions to $464 million for commercial labs to test one person for all known genetic diseases. The debate over the commercialization of human biological materials always comes back to one fundamental point. Like it or not, we live in a market-driven society, and science is part of that market. Baruch Blumberg, the Nobel Prize-winning researcher who used Ted Slavin's antibodies for hepatitis B research, told me, "Whether you think the commercialization of medical research is good or bad depends on how into capitalism you are." On the whole, Blumberg said, commercialization is good. How else would we get the drugs and diagnostic tests we need? Still, he sees a downside. "I think it's fair to say it's interfered with science," he said. "It's changed the spirit. Now there are patents and proprietary information where there once was free information flow. Researchers have become entrepreneurs. That's boomed our economy and created incentives to do research. But it's also brought problems like secrecy and arguments over who owns what." Slavin and Blumberg never used consent forms or ownership transfer agreements. Slavin just held up his arm and gave samples. "We lived in a different ethical and commercial age," Blumberg said. He imagines patients might be less likely to donate now. They probably want to maximize their commercial possibilities, just like everyone else. All the important science Blumberg has done over the years depended on free and unlimited access to tissues. But Blumberg says he doesn't think keeping patients in the dark is the way to get that access. For somebody like Ted, who really needed that money to survive, it would have been wrong to say scientists could commercialize those antibodies, but he couldn't. You know, if someone was going to make money off his antibodies, why shouldn't he have a say in that? Many scientists I've talked to about this issue agree. "This is a capitalist society," says Wayne Grody. "People like Ted Slavin took advantage of that. You know, the way I see it is, if you think of doing that on the front end, more power to you." The thing is, people can't think of doing that on the front end unless they know their tissues might be valuable to researchers in the first place. The difference between Ted Slavin, John Moore, and Henrietta Lacks was that someone told Slavin his tissues were special and that scientists would want to use them in research, so he was able to control his tissues by establishing his terms before anything left his body. In other words, he was informed and he gave consent. In the end, the question is how much science should be obligated, ethically and legally, to put people in the position to do the same as Slavin. Which brings us back to the complicated issue of consent. Just as there is no law requiring informed consent for storing tissues for research, there is no clear requirement for telling donors when their tissues might result in profits. In 2006, an NIH researcher gave thousands of tissue samples to the pharmaceutical company Pfizer in exchange for about $500,000. He was charged with violating a federal conflict of interest law, not because he failed to disclose his financial interest or the value of those tissues to the donors, but because federal researchers aren't allowed to take money from pharmaceutical companies. His case resulted in a congressional investigation and later a hearing. The possible interests of the patients and their lack of knowledge of the value of their samples wasn't mentioned at any point in the process. Though the judge in the John Moore case said patients must be told if their tissues have commercial potential, there was no law enacted to enforce that ruling, so it remains only case law. Today, the decision to disclose this information is up to the institution, and many choose not to tell their patients. Some consent forms don't mention money at all. Others come right out and say, "We may give or sell the specimen and certain medical information about you." Others simply say, "You will receive no reimbursement for donating tissue." Still others embrace confusion. Your sample will be owned by the university. It is unknown whether you will be able to gain, participate in, any financial compensation, payment, from any benefits gained from this research. Tissue rights activists argue that it's essential to disclose any potential financial gain that might come from people's tissues. This isn't about trying to get patients a cut of the financial action, says Lori Andrews. It's about allowing people to express their desires. Clayton agrees, but says, "The fundamental problem here isn't the money. It's the notion that the people these tissues come from don't matter." After the Moore case, Congress held hearings and commissioned reports that uncovered the millions of dollars being made from human tissue research. And it formed a special committee to assess the situation and recommend how to proceed. Its findings, the use of human cells and tissues in biotechnology holds great promise for improving human health, but raises extensive ethical and legal questions that have not been answered and to which no single body of law, policy, or ethics applies. This, they said, must be clarified. In 1999, President Clinton's National Bioethics Advisory Committee, NBAC, issued a report saying that federal oversight of tissue research was inadequate and ambiguous. It recommended specific changes that would ensure patients' rights to control how their tissues were used. It skirted the issue of who should profit from the human body, saying simply that the issue raises a number of concerns and should be investigated further. But little happened. Years later, I asked Wayne Grody, who was in the thick of the debate in the 90s, why the congressional recommendations and NBAC report seem to have vanished. "It's weird, but I have no idea," he said. "If you can figure that out, I'd like to know. We all just wanted to forget about it. Like if we ignored it, maybe it would just go away." But it didn't. And given the steady flow of court cases related to tissues, the issue isn't going away anytime soon. Despite all the other cases and the press they've received, the Lax family has never actually tried to sue anyone over the HeLa cells. Several lawyers and ethicists have suggested to me that since there is no way to anonymize HeLa cells at this point, research on them should be covered by the common rule. And since some of the DNA present in Henrietta's cells is also present in her children, it's possible to argue that by doing research on HeLa, scientists are also doing research on the Lax children. Since the common rule says that research subjects must be allowed to withdraw from research at any time, these experts have told me that in theory, the Lax family might be able to withdraw HeLa cells from all research worldwide. And in fact, there are precedents for such a case, including one in which a woman successfully had her father's DNA removed from a database in Iceland. Every researcher I've mentioned that idea to shudders at the thought of it. Vincent Racaniello, a professor of microbiology and immunology at Columbia University, who once calculated that he's grown about 800 billion HeLa cells for his own research, says that restricting HeLa cell use would be disastrous. "The impact that would have on science is inconceivable," he said. As for the Laxes, they have few legal options. They couldn't sue over the cells being taken in the first place for several reasons, including the fact that the statute of limitations passed decades ago. They could attempt to stop HeLa research through a lawsuit, arguing that it's impossible to anonymize Henrietta's cells, which contain their DNA. But many legal experts I've talked with doubt such a case would succeed. Regardless, the Laxes aren't interested in stopping all HeLa research. "I don't want to cause problems for science," Sonny told me as this book went to press. "Dale wouldn't want that. And besides, I'm proud of my mother and what she done for science. I just hope Hopkins and some of the other folks who benefited off her cells will do something to honor her and make right with the family." What follows is an interview with the author Rebecca Skloot.
Hi, this is Kelly Gilday, producer of the audiobook The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and we're here speaking with the author Rebecca Skloot. Rebecca, this book weaves Henrietta's story and the story of her family with the science of HeLa. Had you always planned to tell her story this way, or did the structure of the book develop organically?
The structure of the book, yeah. No, I definitely didn't plan to tell it that way necessarily. And I wish I could say it developed organically. It was a long, torturous process. But what happened was that as I started kind of going through, as I was researching the book and as I was sort of developing the story in my head, I realized that the book was in some ways as much, if not more, about Deborah and her struggle to understand what happened to her mother and to learn about her mother as it was about Henrietta. And for readers, I was very sort of aware of the fact that if you picked up this book and you just started reading from the beginning with Henrietta going to the hospital and sort of going chronologically forward, you wouldn't meet Deborah until the final section of the book, and it would suddenly become a very different book. It would suddenly be this book about her daughter. And so I wanted readers to know right when they picked up the book, this is not your average science book. This is not just a history of these cells. There's going to be a lot of different voices, and there's this other character who's actually a main character. And so I struggled a lot with how to bring Deborah into the story early on. I started the book with many different chapters. At one point, I had the kind of faith healing that happens with her cousin Gary as the first chapter, which didn't work at all. And because I wanted readers to be able to see, oh, there's something totally different coming down the road. And so that's where the idea for the structure came from, was essentially wanting to let readers, I wanted readers to be able to essentially learn both of the stories at the same time, because as you learn the Laxes story, you really, the story of Henrietta takes on so much more weight because you sort of understand how much, what impact it had on her family and all that. So that's where the idea for the structure came from. And then I spent much time with index cards on a huge blank wall, moving things around and trying to sort of figure out a way to braid those two stories together that wouldn't lose people, you know, jumping around in time and different characters and all that. So it happened organically, but with a lot of intention.
When you set out on this journey to expose the true backstory behind HeLa, did you know that the Lacks family would become such an integral part of that story?
I had no idea. I had always been interested in her family, and I had always been curious about what their reaction was to the cells, but I had no idea what they'd really been through. And so I just had no concept that their story was as kind of involved as it was as difficult as it was, or as such an important part of the story of the cells. I kind of went into it thinking I was sure they would have some interesting things to say about their feelings about their mother's cells being alive all these years after her death, but I didn't have any concept of how, of what that story might be. And I really thought the book would be about Henrietta and herself, basically a sort of biography of the two of them with some bits of the story of her family in there, until that first phone call. And I called Deborah that very first time, and we had this, and she did this sort of almost manic brain dump where I just said, you know, I basically introduced myself, and she talked about all these things, and I didn't understand most of them. They were all little bits of things. Somebody had murdered somebody. Somebody tried to steal something having to do with her mother. There were all these sort of hints at this bigger story, and hearing those little snippets, but also just the absolute sort of terror in her voice and how she obviously desperately wanted to talk about this stuff and wanted to know about this stuff, but was also very scared. That was the moment when I went, oh, this is a much bigger story than just a story about these cells. Something happened to this family, and I don't understand what it is, but I have to find out. And that's when the book sort of went off in that other direction.
You hit so many roadblocks along the way, many put up by the Lax family themselves. Did you ever come close to quitting, and what compelled you to stay so persistent?
Amazingly, no. I didn't ever come close to quitting. I definitely got frustrated along the way, and I definitely wondered if I was ever going to be able to finish. I kind of envisioned myself at 60 still working on this book, but I never considered stopping. And I think a lot of that, you know, had to do with my feelings about how important the story was to tell. And it's such an important story in the history of medicine that hadn't been told, and I really felt strongly about getting that out there. I felt that telling the story of Henrietta Lacks was incredibly important and all that. But in a lot of ways, the thing that actually kept me going, and, you know, when I started to feel really kind of almost beaten down by the story, was talking about it. I would, you know, I'd go to, whether I was at a party or in a coffee shop, sort of wherever I would meet people, you know, it always comes up, what do you do? I'm a writer working on a book. Well, what's your book about? And whenever I told people the story, their reaction was just, they were stunned. And they were filled with questions, you know, was it legal for them to take these cells? And what did all this mean for the family? And watching the way that people reacted to the story whenever I talked about it really helped keep me going. And a lot of writers talk about the fact that they don't talk about books as they're working on them. They say, you know, I've heard many writers say it's sort of when you tell the story out loud, it can kind of weaken the story as you write it. They worry that it'll be less fresh on the page if they've talked about it a lot. And for me, it was exactly the opposite. The more I talked about it, the more I was sort of revitalized by the people and the way that they heard the story as I told it. And the questions they would ask would sort of keep a lot of the information of the story fresh in my head. And each time I told the story, I'd tell it a little bit differently. And so that response from, and whether they were scientists or a friend of the family or sort of whoever it was that I was telling the story to, it really kept me going because it reminded me why I was doing this. Like, I was doing this because it's an important story and people react so intensely to it because it is so powerful and so important.
While exploring Henrietta's life and the history of Gila, what was the most exciting discovery you came across?
Okay, the most exciting discovery was that moment of sort of discovering Dr. Patillo and then having him put me in touch with Deborah. Because that was really, for me, that was the moment where I thought, oh, this is actually going to happen. This could actually be a book. And the moment that I hung up the phone with Deborah, that very first conversation we had, I hung up the phone and I was working at the University of Pittsburgh at the time, and it was after hours, so I didn't know anyone was even in the building. And I hung up the phone and I screamed at the top of my lungs. I was so excited and sort of terrified, and I was like, oh my God, I felt like I'd gotten myself into something that was much bigger than I could really understand at that moment. And so I just put down the phone and screamed really loud, and I didn't know my boss was there. And she came running down the hall thinking someone was attacking me. And I just couldn't, I was sort of hopping up and down and running in circles. I was just so excited that I had finally gotten to talk to Deborah and that it felt like the book was really going to happen. So in terms of excitement, I think that was really the moment for me. I don't know that it's a discovery necessarily, but it was certainly the most I screamed, so.
And what was the most upsetting discovery?
the discovery of what happened to Deborah's sister. Neither one of us expected that. And, you know, I went into the story, and Deborah went into the sort of process of doing this with me, knowing that her mother had had a very painful death. And we were sort of prepared for anything we found in the medical records. But the moment when Paul Lurz pulled out the autopsy report and we saw the picture of Deborah's sister, and that was, I mean, that was one of the most devastating moments sort of my life. And it was really, it was a very traumatic picture to look at, but also just knowing this, realizing that there was a horrible story behind it, and also worrying very much about Deborah and sort of wanting to protect her from it, but knowing that I couldn't because she was right there with me in the moment it happened. And then the more we looked into that, the more we learned about it, the worse it was. And then after the fact, I did a lot of research and talked to various people and found that Elsie had been used in those research studies without her knowledge, without the family's knowledge, and that those were actually incredibly painful, unpleasant things for her to have gone through. And that really was the most deeply disturbing thing that I came across in the research process.
The death of Deborah really takes the listener's breath away. Can you describe your feelings toward the project upon learning of Deborah's passing? Did it give it more gravity?
Yeah, you know, I think it'll take me probably a long time to really, in some ways, even be able to wrap my mind around the fact that she's gone. That was utterly devastating for me. She and I had gotten very close over the process of my working on the book all of these years, and it was unexpected, but it was also not a huge surprise. I mean, I knew she, you know, she had had a stroke in the past, and, you know, I knew that she had blood pressure problems and things, but I wasn't ready for it. In a lot of ways, it was my worst fear come true, because, you know, that she used to tease me all the time because it took so long to do this book, and she would joke around and say, you know, you better finish this thing before I die, because I want to, you know, I want to see it, and we would laugh. And then in the end, she didn't get to see it. She actually died the day that the book went on pre-sale. The day that people could start ordering the book online was the day that she died. And she was never able to actually hold the book in her hand. She was never able to flip through the pages and read some of it. And that was very hard for me. And at the same time, you know, she knew what was in the book. We had talked through a lot of it, and I felt like she had, you know, I don't feel like, you know, her death sort of prevented her from learning the story from others. She obviously did that as we were sort of traveling and doing some of the research together. But yeah, it takes on a gravity, and her absence is very present for me whenever I do anything, any interview I do, any public appearance, and she's sort of there with me in my head, you know, and she wanted very badly to go out and talk to people about the book, and she would have been so excited to hear people's responses. And so that, it gives me, in a sense, the gravity of, it makes, I guess, oh, I'm going to have to sort of think about this. I think part of what it does is that it doesn't so much increase the gravity of the book, but it does make me feel like, it does sort of increase the gravity of my need to go out and talk about it, because she so wanted to do that. She just wanted to travel. She wanted to go on TV shows. She wanted to go meet people in bookstores and just talk to them about her mother, because that was, you know, her whole life. No one would talk to her about her mother, and now after the book comes out, everybody wants to talk about her mother, and the fact that she isn't able to be there for that is very sad, but at the same time, I know that she would be thrilled by the interest and by the fact that people are finally talking about her mother. You know, and in some ways I feel like she decided not to actually read the book, because I had finished a draft of the manuscript and long before she died, and called her and said, okay, it's done. And we had talked about whether I was going to read it to her. She didn't want to read it herself, because we were both worried that she would have a hard time with some of the information in the book and that it might cause her to get sick again. And so we had had this plan where I was going to read it to her and then sort of omit certain points and say, okay, here's the part where, you know, your mother's dying and it's pretty painful. Do you want me to read it to you, or do you want me to just sort of skip this part because we know what happened? And we were actually in the process of planning the trip where I was going to go to read it to her when she died. And And she had been sort of putting it off a little bit to say, okay, yeah, we're going to do it. Let's plan it. And I think she was sort of not quite ready for it. And so the fact that she died before we had that moment, I almost feel like she sort of made a decision that she just sort of wanted the book. She wanted to let go of the book and let it go out in the world without her actually reliving it all again. For me, Deborah is still incredibly alive. You know, I have all these tapes of us talking, and I listen to them periodically, and I have videos, and she's in my head, and she has lived in my head for the last 10 years, and I hear her voice all the time, and for me, it's very, I feel like I haven't quite accepted the fact that she's actually dead, and it really, in some ways, feels very appropriate with her story and with her mother's story, because that's the same way that she felt about her mother. In some ways, you know, her cells were still alive. She was gone, but she wasn't gone. And there was some part of her that was still so present in the world and is still so present in the world. And so I have that same experience with Deborah, and I hope that readers will too, that she's very much alive for me. And I, you know, when I go to Baltimore now, I really, there's a side of me that sort of expects that she's going to be there. And I think that in some ways, as I go and travel and talk about the book, I imagine that the realization that she really is gone will hit me at some point. But in some ways, I feel like even that, it's like, she's not really gone. You know, there's this sort of, she's here and she's not here. And, you know, her death happened very late in the book process. I had worked on the book for almost 10 years, and it was finished. I had written an ending. It was done. And it was basically going through the editing process to be published when she died. And then I had to essentially rewrite the end of the book to include her her death and the sort of what followed. And that was a sort of amazing thing of having to go back and essentially open the book back up again and say, wait, the story wasn't actually over. And in some ways that feels appropriate too for Deborah, this sort of idea that, you know, the story never really ends because the cells never die, and Deborah will sort of always be here, her in her voice and through her story.
What is the most important lesson you'd like listeners to take away from this book?
The answer to that sort of varies depending on who the listener is. You know, there for scientists, this story is incredibly powerful because it's this reminder of the fact that there is a human being behind every single tissue sample, every, you know, gene they work with in the lab, and that those people and their families often have lives and experiences associated with those samples that, after the fact, that scientists don't usually know about. I mean, most scientists who read the book, many of them have said to me, I've been working with HeLa my entire career, and I never thought to ask where they came from. I just never even wondered who this person was, and for them, it's a very transformative experience, a lot of them. And so I hope there's a part of the book that, in terms of that readership, that's definitely one of my goals, is I hope that they come away with this, sort of looking at tissue samples in a slightly different way as bits of people with stories. And for the general public, you know, what I don't want them to take away from the book is that tissue and cell and tissue research is bad. That was one thing that I was very concerned about as I was writing the book, because I tried very hard to strike a balance where I showed the incredible promise of cell and tissue culture and how much of medicine and our lives rely on research on these tissues. And, you know, often people hear this, and sometimes people hear the story of Henrietta and they say, oh, I'm not going to let doctors take my cells and do things with them. It sounds very nefarious and scary. And, you know, I want people to, in a sense, I want readers to learn about the complexity of the issues behind cell and tissue culture, that it's so incredibly important for medicine and for our health, and at the same time that it raises some issues that everyone should be aware of and that people, you know, should be thinking of in terms of, okay, so we do need this science to happen. What kind of regulations or what kind of procedures do we need in order to make it so that can happen in a way that's good for everyone? So that's definitely part of what I hope readers take from it. And also just, you know, the importance of communicating about science. You know, in a lot of ways, this book is about a lack of communication and inability for scientists to explain things on a level that's basic enough for the general public to understand them. And also, you know, a lack of sort of education enough to really understand some of the science and the ways in which science sort of can affect our daily lives are vast, and there are so many different reasons why it is important for people to be able to talk about science and for scientists to be able to talk about it in a way that's accessible to the general public, and also for regular folks who sort of feel like, oh, science, I don't know anything about science, I don't like science, it's sort of, but to sort of be open to learning a bit about science and the way that it impacts our lives.
Well, Rebecca, thanks so much for taking time today to talk to us about your new audiobook.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. Read by Cassandra Campbell with Bonnie Turpin. Executive producers Kelly Gilday and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2010 by Rebecca Skloot. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.